We recently had some conversation on our church email list about a new icon that is being painted for us by our generous friend Patricia Begg. And the conversation was about what to include in it and what to leave out. It's the Easter icon, sometimes titled the Resurrection and more traditionally titled the Harrowing of Hades or the Land of the Dead. There are many different versions of this icon in the tradition, and they include more or less detail. And Patricia favoured a greatly simplified version that removed the background mountains, most of the people, and the image of the defeated devil in the abyss, so as to focus all the attention on the central image of Christ rising from the land of the dead, lifting humanity, represented by Adam and Eve, to new life with him. As you can see from the picture of the work in progress, the majority of opinion of our congregation went the other way and wanted them all included. It was a majority, but it wasn't a total consensus. And I have a theory about the meaning of the different opinions, and my theory also relates to the ways that we interpret a story like the one we just heard now of Jesus being confronted in the wilderness by the Satan. You may have heard people say that our generation is experiencing a shift from a modernist worldview to a postmodern worldview. Some of you may even know what that means. But if nothing else, it means that in a group of people as diverse as us, there will be differences in the ways that we view the world and interpret reality. And my theory is that our reactions to the details in the icon roughly reflect these differences. I am about the right age to be influenced almost equally by both, which mostly means that I'm just confused, and in a discussion like the one about the icon, I'm quite easily swayed back and forth by the arguments from each poll. Modernism was born of the massive shift of perspective that came about as science showed us that the world was round, that it orbited an obscure star in an isolated galaxy, that life had evolved over millions of years, and that most illnesses were caused by bacteria or viruses and not by demons. Although there are still groups who respond to these earth-shattering realizations by clinging ever more desperately to a pre-modern literal reading of every detail of the biblical stories and defending them against the threat of scientific inquiry, most Christians of the modernist era embraced the new way of thinking. A lot of Christian theology set about demythologizing the Bible, that is, deciding which elements could be dismissed as simply reflecting the flat earth worldview of the biblical writers and set aside to allow us to focus on the pure essence of the message of Jesus. Now, the ongoing conflicts with those who were clinging to the pre-modern literalist approach has meant that sometimes when a scientific modernist mindset encounters a story like the one we heard tonight, we almost instinctively begin by thinking, well, of course, I'm not like those crazies who believe in a personal devil who pops up in the wilderness. The story is just about Jesus confronting difficult options, some of which were very tempting but wrong. And sometimes, having established that we don't believe what the crazies believe, we forget to go much further and really dig into what God is wanting to say to us through this apparently pre-modern imagery. And this reaction can become even stronger when we consider a visual representation like an icon, because the visual medium seems to more strongly imply a literal reading of what it depicts. So this icon that depicts Jesus entering the land of the dead, where he meets and raises to life people who have been dead for hundreds or thousands of years, and furthermore depicts a devil chained and falling into the abyss, can seem like a lot of naive foolishness that plays right into the hands of the fundamentalists. And if you are my age or older and your education was dominated more by the sciences than by things like philosophy and literary theory, there's a fair chance that you're recognising yourself in these responses as I describe them. If you're older than me but your natural habitat was among philosophers and social or literary theorists, then you probably got a head start on the postmodern worldview. But most people younger than me are now thoroughly shaped by it. And when it comes to listening to the biblical stories or considering an icon, the postmodern perspective is not really a rejection of the modernist perspective. In fact, in many ways, it simply takes it for granted and has already moved on. While the modernists among us are still thinking, do we really believe in a land of the dead and a literal devil, or isn't it all metaphorical? The postmodernists are looking at the same picture and saying, that depicts what my life often feels like. How do I embrace the hope that's being expressed here? It's not that they're falling for the literal reading of the details. It's just that they can't see any point in asking whether it's literally true. It's true to the way they feel, to the way they experience life, and that's why they respond positively to it. So some of us responded to the question about the icon by saying, "Ooh, I don't like seeing those things depicted like that because they're just metaphors." While others, more of us in fact, responded by saying, "Of course they're metaphors and I really like relate to them and I'd like to see more of them in the icon, all of them, maybe even a few more." Tonight, we're celebrating the journey of a number of people into the life of God and into the membership of our church. We've enrolled 2 people in our catechumenate and 6 people into the final 40 days of the catechumenate, after which they will be accepted by reaffirmation of their baptismal vows into the membership of our church. This is exciting and encouraging stuff. Many churches will be doing something similar today, and many more will be wishing they could be doing something similar today. So why is it that the lectionary compilers, in their wisdom, chose to make sure that we listen to one of the accounts of Jesus being tempted by the Satan on this particular Sunday every year? Well, after all, you might say this story actually happens shortly after Jesus' baptism, not during his preparation for it. So what are we reading it here for? Well, that's true, but Jesus himself often suggested that his impending death was a baptism too, or that perhaps that it was the completion of his baptism. And in our baptismal rites, we make that connection too, recognising that Jesus is calling us to follow him through the deep waters of suffering and death and on into the promised land of resurrection life. So one of the reasons that the ancient church developed the catechumena was to give both the candidate and the church the time and the means to check each other out. What the church was looking for was whether the applicant had developed the disciplines and attitudes and resilience to see them through the tough journey ahead. Our friend Michael Harden points out that that in many indigenous cultures, the initiation rites that prepared people for leadership as elders or shamans or healers, frequently after a period of apprenticeship, involved a tough survival test in the wilderness. And he suggests that the story that we heard tonight is that same thing for Jesus. Having completed his apprenticeship, the Spirit drives him out into the wilderness where he wrestles with some horrendously complex and difficult questions about what sort of person he is going to be on the road ahead. Now, one of the problems with the catechumenate is so often it has been turned into the idea that it's just about teaching people certain ways of believing things. But actually, it doesn't matter whether we view this story through pre-modern, post-modern, or modernist eyes. The challenge is the same. Whether you think that the temptations are being thrown at you by a literal prince of evil, or whether you think that that's all just an anachronistic metaphor, or whether you just know what it means to wrestle with integrity challenges and other temptations and can't see the relevance of trying to sort out exactly where they come from, the challenge is the same. Whether it's a literal devil or our own psychological frailties or the strong current of cultural pressure, you will consistently face similar temptations to those that Jesus faced. Will you take shortcuts to attract attention and win fans? Will you compromise your integrity to gain power and gratify your ego? Will you try to manipulate God into being and doing what you want? When our catechumens reach the end of their initial journey of formation and ask us to baptize them into the life of God and the membership of the church, we won't be asking them to give answers to questions about the ontology of Satan or the biology of resurrection or the geography of heaven and hell. They will probably be all over the place on those questions, just like the rest of us, and that's absolutely fine. What we will be looking for is whether they have developed the spirituality and resilience to follow Jesus on the pathways of faithfulness, integrity, and tenaciously inclusive love and mercy. In the ancient church, the questions they asked when deciding whether to baptize a catechumen, whether they were ready, were things like, does she visit the sick and the poor? Does she welcome the refugee and the outcast? Does she pray for those who persecute her? We're aiming to follow that example. God and God's love and mercy are so much bigger than the fickle constructs that we put on our attempts to interpret reality. And when you know yourself totally immersed, bathed and soaked in God's love and mercy, then those temptations, wherever you think they come from, will become a whole lot easier to recognize and to rise above.